For almost 20 years, Marcus Archer had owned the old farmhouse at Rivonia. He had purchased the 5-acre smallholding before the area became fashionable. Now the fairways and greens of the Johannesburg Country Club, the most exclusive private club on the Witwatersrand, backed right up against Marcus' boundary. The trustees of the country club had offered him 15 times his original purchase price, over £100,000, but Marcus steadfastly refused to sell. On all the other large plots that comprised the Rivonia estate, the prosperous new owners, entrepreneurs and stockbrokers and successful doctors, had built large pretentious homes, most of them in the low sprawling ranch house style, which was the rage, or with pink clay tile roofs, imaginative copies of Mexican haciendas or Mediterranean villas, and they had surrounded the main buildings with paddocks and stables, with tennis courts and swimming pools, and wide lawns that the winter Highveld frosts burned the colour of cured tobacco leaves. Marcus Archer had rethatched the roof of the old farmhouse, whitewashed the walls, and planted frangipani and bougainvillea and other flowering shrubs, and let the grounds grow wild and unkempt, so that even from its own boundary fence the house was completely screened. Although the area was now very much a bastion of the wealthy white elite, the country club employed a large staff of waiters and kitchen helpers and groundsmen and golf caddies, so black faces were not remarkable, as they might have been on the streets of some of the other wealthy white suburbs. Marcus's friends and political allies could come and go without arousing unwelcome interest. So Puck's Hill, as Marcus had recently renamed his farmhouse, gradually became the rallying ground for some of the most active of the African nationalist movements, the leaders of black consciousness and their white compatriots, the remnants of the defunct Communist Party. It was only natural, therefore, that Puck's Hill was chosen as the headquarters for the final planning and coordination of the black disobedience campaign that was about to begin. However, it was not a unified group that came together under Marcus Archer's roof, for although their stated final objective was the same, their separate visions of the future differed widely. Firstly, there was the old guard of the African National Congress, headed by Dr. Zuma. They were the conservatives, committed to plodding negotiation with white civil servants within the unyielding established system. "You people have been doing that since 1912, when the ANC was formed," Nelson Mandela glared at him. "It is time to move on to confrontation, to force our will upon the Boers." Nelson Mandela was a young lawyer, practicing on the Witwatersrand in partnership with another activist named Oliver Tambo. Together they were making a strong challenge for the leadership of the Young Turks in the Congress hierarchy. "It is time for us to move on to direct action," Nelson Mandela leaned forward in his chair and looked down the long kitchen table. The kitchen was the largest room in Puck's Hill, and all their meetings were held in it. "We have drawn up a program of boycott and strike and civil disobedience." Mandela was speaking in English, and Moses Gama, sitting near the end of the table, watched him impassively. But all the time his mind was racing ahead of the speaker, assessing and evaluating. He, as much as any of them present, was aware of the undertones in the room. There was not a single black man present who did not cherish somewhere in his soul the dream of one day leading all the others, of one day being hailed as the paramount chief of all Southern Africa. Yet the fact that Mandela spoke in English pointed up the single most poignant fact that they had to face. They were all different. Mandela was a Tembu. Zuma was a Zulu. Moses Gama himself was an Ovambo. And there were half a dozen other tribes represented in the room. "It would be 100 times easier if we blacks were all one people," Moses thought. And then despite himself, he glanced uneasily at the Zulus, sitting together as a group across the table. They were the majority, not only in this room, but in the country as a whole. What if they somehow formed an alliance with the whites? It was a disquieting thought, but he put it firmly aside. The Zulus were the proudest, most independent of the warrior tribes. Before the white man came, they had conquered all their neighbouring peoples and held them subjugated. The Zulu king, Shaka, had called them his dogs. Because of their multitudes and their warrior tradition, it was almost certain that the first black president of South Africa would be a Zulu, or someone with very close ties to the Zulu nation, ties of marriage. Not for the first time, Moses thought about the possibility with narrowed eyes. It was time he married, anyway. He was almost 45 years of age. A Zulu maiden of royal blood, perhaps? He stored the idea for future consideration and concentrated once again on what Nelson Mandela was saying. The man had charisma and a presence, and he was articulate and persuasive. A rival, a very dangerous rival. Moses recognized that fact, as he had often done before. They were all rivals. However, the Youth League of the ANC was Nelson Mandela's power base, the hotheads, young men burning for action, and even now Mandela was proposing caution, tempering his call for action with reservations. "There must be no gratuitous violence," he was saying, "no damage to private property, no danger to human life." And although Moses Gama nodded wisely, he wondered how much appeal that would have with the rank and file of the Youth League. Would they not prefer the offer of a bloody and glorious victory? That was something else to be considered. "We must show our people the way. We must demonstrate that we are all one in this enterprise," Mandela was saying now, and Moses Gama smiled inwardly. The total membership of the ANC was 7,000, while his secret union of mine workers numbered almost 10 times that figure. It would be as well to remind Mandela and the rest of them of his overwhelming support amongst the best paid and most strategically placed of all the black population. Moses turned slightly and looked at the man who sat beside him and felt an untoward pang of affection. Hendrik Tabaka had been beside him like this for 20 years. Swart Hendrik was a big man, as tall as Moses, but wider across the shoulder and heavier around the middle, with thick, muscled limbs. His head was round and bald as a cannonball and laced with scars from ancient fights and battles. His front teeth were missing, and Moses remembered how the white man who had done that to him had died. He was Moses' half-brother, son of the same father, a chief of the Ovambo, but of a different mother. He was the one man in all the world whom Moses trusted, a trust not lightly given, but earned over all of those 20 years. He was the only black man in this room who was not a rival, but was instead both comrade and loyal servant. Swart Hendrik nodded at him unsmilingly, and Moses realized that Nelson Mandela had finished speaking and that they were all watching him, waiting for him to reply. He rose slowly to his feet, aware of the impression he was making, and he could see the respect in their expressions. Even his enemies in the room could not entirely conceal the awe which he inspired. "Comrades," he began, "my brothers, I have listened to what my good brother Nelson Mandela has said, and I agree with every word of it. There are just a few points which I feel I must add." And he spoke for nearly an hour. Firstly, he proposed to them a detailed plan to call a series of wildcat strikes in the mines where the labor force was controlled by his unions. "Their strikes will be in sympathy with the defiance campaign, but we will not call a general strike which would give the Boers an excuse for heavy-handed action. We will bring out only a few mines at any one time, and then only for a limited period, before going back to work, just enough to thoroughly disrupt gold production and to exasperate management. We will nip at their heels like a terrier harassing a lion, ready to spring away the instant he turns. But it will be a warning. It will let them realize our strength and what would happen if we called a general strike." He saw how they were impressed with his planning, and when he asked for a vote to confirm his proposal, he was given unanimous approval. It was another small victory, another addition to his prestige and influence within the group. "In addition to the strike action, I would like to propose a boycott of all white-owned business on the Witwatersrand for the duration of the defiance campaign. The people will be allowed to buy their necessities of life from shops owned and run by black businessmen only." Hendrik Tabaka owned over 50 large general dealer stores in the black townships along the Gold Reef, and Moses Gama was his sleeping partner. He saw the others at the table balk at the suggestion, and Mandela objected. "It will cause undue hardship amongst our people," he said, Many of them live in areas where they can trade only with white stores. Then they must travel to areas where there are black-owned businesses, and it will do our people no harm to learn that the struggle demands sacrifices from all of us," Moses answered. "A boycott such as you propose would be impossible to enforce," Mandela insisted, and this time Hendrik Tabaka replied to the objection. "We will use the buffaloes to make sure the people obey," he growled. And now the more conservative members of the council looked positively unhappy. The buffaloes were the union enforcers. Hendrik Tabaka was their commander, and they had a reputation for swift, ruthless action. They were too close to being a private political army for the peace of mind of some of the other men in the room, and Moses Gama frowned slightly. It had been a mistake for Hendrik to mention his buffaloes at all. Moses hid his chagrin when the vote to declare a boycott of white dealers on the Witwatersrand and enforce it strictly was defeated. It was a victory for Mandela and his moderates. So far the score was even, but Moses was not finished yet. "There is one other matter I would like to bring up before we adjourn. I would like to consider what lies beyond the defiance campaign. What action do we take if the campaign is crushed by ruthless white police action and followed by an onslaught on the black leaders and the promulgation of even more draconian laws of domination?" he asked. "Will our response always be mild and subservient? Will we always take off our caps and mutter, 'Yes, my baas,' or 'No, my white baas'?" He paused and studied the others, seeing the disquiet he had expected in the faces of old Tuma and the conservatives. But he had not spoken for them. At the far end of the table there were two young men still in their early 20s. They were observers from the executive of the youth lead of the ANC, and Moses knew them both to be militants longing for fierce action. What he was about to say now was for them, and he knew they would take his words back to their other young warriors. It would begin the erosion of Nelson Mandela's support amongst the youth, and the transference of that support to a leader who was prepared to give them the blood and fire for which they hungered. "I propose the formation of a military wing of the ANC," Moses said. "A fighting force of trained men, ready to die for the struggle. Let us call this army Amkonto Wesizwe, the spear of the nation. Let us forge the spear secretly. Let us hone its edge to razor sharpness, keeping it hidden, but always ready to strike." He used that deep, thrilling tone of his, and he saw the two young men at the end of the table stir eagerly and their faces begin to glow with expectation. "Let us choose our brightest and fiercest young men, and from them form the impis as our forefathers did." He paused, and his expression became scornful. "There are old men among us, and they are wise. I respect their grey hairs and their experience. But remember, comrades, the future belongs to the young. There is a time for fine words, and we have heard them spoken at our councils, often, too often. There is a time also for action, bold action, and that is the world of the young." When at last Moses Gama sat down, he saw that he had moved them all deeply, each in his separate way. Old Zuma was shaking his grey pate, and his lips quivered. He knew his day had passed. Nelson Mandela and Oliver Tambo watched him impassively. But he saw the fury in their hearts beam through their eyes. The battle lines had been drawn, and they had recognized their enemy. Yet, most important of all, he saw the expressions on the faces of the two youth leaguers. It was the look of men who had found a new star to follow. "Since when have you conceived such a burning interest in archaeological anthropology?" Shasa Courtney asked as he shook out the pages of the Cape Times and turned from the financial section to the sports pages at the rear. "It was one of my majors," Tara pointed out reasonably. "May I pour you another cup of coffee?" "Thank you, my dear." He sipped the coffee before he spoke again. "How long do you intend to be away?" "Professor Dart will be giving a series of four lectures on successive evenings, covering all the excavations from his original discovery of the Taung skull right up to the present time. he has been able to correlate the whole mass of material with one of these new electronic computers. Behind his newspaper, Shaza smiled reflectively as he remembered Mary Lee from MIT and her IBM 701. He wouldn't mind another visit to Johannesburg himself in the near future. "It's absolutely riveting stuff," Tara was saying, "and it all fits in with the new discoveries at Sterkfontein and Makapansgat. It really does seem that Southern Africa was the true cradle of mankind, and that Australopithecus is our direct ancestor." "So you'll be away for at least 4 days," Shasa interrupted. "What about the children?" "I've spoken to your mother. She'll be happy to come across and stay at Veltefrieden while I'm away." "I won't be able to join you," Shasa pointed out. "The third reading of the new Criminal Law Amendment Bill is coming up, and all hands are needed in the house. I could have flown you up in the Mosquito. Now you'll have to take the commercial flight on the Viscount." "Oh, what a pity," Tara sighed. "You would have enjoyed it. Professor Dart is a fascinating speaker." "You'll stay in the Carlton suite, of course. It's standing empty." "Molly has arranged for me to stay with a friend of hers at Rivonia." "One of her bolshies, I presume," Shaza frowned slightly. "Try not to get yourself arrested again." He'd been waiting for an opportunity to talk about her political activities, and he lowered the newspaper and looked at her thoughtfully, then realized it was not the correct moment, and merely nodded. "Your grass orphans and your widower will try to bumble along without you for a few days." "With your mother and 16 servants at hand, I have no doubt you will survive," she told him crisply, letting her irritation show through for an instant. Marcus Archer met her at the airport. He was affable and amusing, and while they listened to a Mozart program on the car radio as they drove out to Rivonia, Marcus discussed the composer's life and works. He knew much more about music than she did. But although she listened to his dissertation with pleasure and attention, she was nevertheless aware of his enmity. It was well concealed, but flashed out in a barbed remark or a spiced glance. He never mentioned Moses Garmer's name, nor did she. Molly had said he was a homosexual, the first she had ever encountered to her certain knowledge, and she wondered if they all hated women. Puck's Hill was a delight, with its shaggy thatch and unkempt grounds, so different from Veltefrieden's carefully manicured splendour. "You'll find him at the end of the front stoop," Marcus said, as he parked under one of the blue gums at the rear of the house. It was the first time he had referred to Moses, but even then he did not use his name. He wandered away and left her standing. She had not known how to dress, though she imagined that he would not approve of slacks. So she had chosen a long, loose skirt made of cheap but colourful trade print that she had purchased in Swaziland, and with it wore a simple green cotton blouse with sandals on her feet. Again, she had not been sure whether she should wear makeup, and she had compromised with a pale pink lipstick and just a touch of mascara. She thought she looked well enough in the mirror of the women's room at the airport as she combed her dense chestnut curls, but was suddenly stricken by the thought that he would find her pale skin insipid and unattractive. Now, standing alone in the sunshine, she was once again attacked by doubts and that terrible sense of inadequacy. If Marcus had been there, she would have begged him to drive her back to the airport, but he had disappeared, and so she summoned up all her courage and walked slowly around the side of the whitewashed house. She paused at the corner and looked down the long, covered veranda. Moses Garmer was sitting at a table at the far end with his back to her. The table was piled with books and writing materials. He was wearing a casual white shirt with open neck that contrasted with the marvellous anthracite of his skin. His head was bowed, and he was writing rapidly on a block of notepaper. Timidly, she stepped up onto the veranda, and although her approach was noiseless, he sensed her presence and turned abruptly when she was halfway down the veranda. He did not smile, but she thought she saw pleasure in his gaze as he stood up and came to meet her. He did not attempt to embrace her or kiss her, and she was pleased, for it confirmed his differentness. Instead, he led her to the second chair placed beside his table and seated her in it. "Are you well?" he asked, Are your children well? The innate African courtesy, always the inquiry, and then the offer of refreshment. Let me give you a cup of tea. He poured from the tray already set on his cluttered desk, and she sipped with pleasure. Thank you for coming, he said. I came as soon as I received your message from Molly, as I promised I would. Will you always keep your promises to me? Always, she answered with simple sincerity, and he studied her face. Yes, he nodded. I think you will. She could hold his gaze no longer, for it seemed to sear her soul and lay it bare. She looked down at the tabletop, at the closely written sheets of his handwriting. A manifesto, he said, following her gaze. A blueprint for the future. He selected half a dozen sheets and handed them to her. She set aside her teacup and took them from his hand, shivering slightly as their fingers touched. His skin was cool. That was one of the things that she had remembered. She read the sheets, her attention becoming fastened upon them more firmly the more she read. And when she finished them, she lifted her eyes to his face again. You have a poetry in your choice of words that makes the truth shine more luminously, she whispered. They sat on the cool veranda while outside the brilliant high-felt sun threw shadows black and crisp as paper cutouts beneath the trees, and the noonday swooned in the heat, and they talked. There were no trivialities in their discussion. Everything he said was thrilling and cogent, and he seemed to inspire her, for her replies and her own observations she knew were measured and lucid, and she saw she had aroused and held his interest. She no longer was aware of her small vanities of dress and cosmetics. All that mattered now were the words that they exchanged and the cocoon they wove out of them. With a start, she realized that the day had slipped away unnoticed and the short African twilight was upon them. Marcus came to fetch her and show her to her sparsely furnished bedroom. "We'll leave for the museum in 20 minutes," he told her. In the lecture theatre of the Transvaal Museum, the three of them sat near the back. There were half a dozen other blacks in the crowded audience, but Marcus sat between the two of them. A black man beside a white woman would have excited interest, and certain hostility. Tara found it difficult to concentrate on the eminent professor's address, and though she glanced in his direction only once or twice, it was Moses Gama who occupied all her thoughts. Back at Puck's Hill, they sat late in the cavernous kitchen while Marcus hovered over the Aga stove, joining in their conversation while he produced a meal that even in her preoccupation Tara realized was as good as anything that had ever come out of the kitchens of Welter Frieden. It was after midnight when Marcus stood up abruptly. "I'll see you in the morning," he said, and the look he gave Tara was once again spiced with venom. She could not understand how she had offended him. But soon it did not matter, for Moses took her hand. "Come," he said softly, and she thought her legs might not support her weight. Long afterwards, she lay pressed to him, her body bathed in sweat, and her nerves still spasming and twitching uncontrollably. "Never," she whispered, when she could speak again. "I have never known anyone like you. You teach me things about myself that I never suspected. You are a magician, Moses Gama. How do you know so much about a woman?" He chuckled softly. "You know we are entitled to many wives. If a man cannot keep them all happy at the same time, then his life becomes a torment. He has to learn." "Do you have many wives?" she asked. "Not yet," he answered. "But one day. I'll hate every one of them." "Oh, you disappoint me," he said. "Sexual jealousy is a silly European emotion. If I were to detect it in you, I would despise you." "Please," she said quietly, "never despise me." "Then never give me reason, woman," he commanded. And she knew she was his to command.